Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. Welcome to Bletchley Park. I'm Ian Stand and I'm the Chief Executive of the Bletchley Park Trust. It's my pleasure to welcome you here today to this book launch. I'm not going to waffle on. I'm just going to introduce you to Dermot Turing, who's going to talk about the book and about Alan Turing. Afterwards, there's an opportunity for you to buy a book outside in the billiard room, and Dermot will be there to sign the book for those who wish it. Dermot, over to you.
Thank you, Ian. And I'd like to add my welcome to virtually to all of you. It's a rather special occasion. I'm not just talking about the fact that the sun is shining for the first time in many weeks, but as I'm sure you know, 2012 is the centenary year of the birth of Alan Turing, and I'm sure you also know that as well as being one of the foremost codebreakers here at Bletchley, he had just this amazing array of other achievements during his short life, laying the theoretical foundation stones of modern computer science and taking the first steps towards turning into mathematical equations the processes that happen when a spherical cell turns into a rather ungainly, asymmetrically shaped thing like a human being. Quite astonishing achievements, and for any man, and to think that he did all those things before reaching his 42nd birthday. I think it must be a terrible thing to lose your child, and I can't really imagine how my grandmother felt about it. She decided to write a biography of her extraordinary son, and this was published in 1959. And of course, back then, really, absolutely nothing was known about what had happened here at Bletchley Park. As we all know, that's one of the war's most tightly guarded secrets at the time. And so nothing was known about either what he had done, his contribution, or indeed what the achievements at Bletchley had meant in terms of the development of the war. And the reputation of Alan Turing in the late 1950s was really confined to a really small intellectual group of people who had worked with him in the fields of mathematics and artificial intelligence, and of course the secret people who had been here at Bletchley and knew things that they could not talk about. So against that background, the print run of my grandmother's book was really very small, and it's become something of a collector's item as Alan Turing's reputation has grown in the intervening decades. So I have to say it was really very exciting news to hear that Cambridge University Press were going to be able to reissue the book in a centenary edition, and this time it's got a new preface by Professor Martin Davis, who is able to put Alan's technical work into a more professional context than my grandmother was able to do. And it's also got a short memoir by my father, which gives a rather different personal perspective on Alan from the viewpoint of the exasperated elder brother. Now, as I mentioned, my grandmother had really no idea what Alan had been up to at Bletchley, so I thought I'd read to you what she actually says about that. She says, "We'd given up our home in Guildford in March 1939, and being mostly on the move until war broke out, we saw little of Alan. During the next 6 years, he could only spend snatches of leave with us, for immediately on the declaration of war, he was taken on as a temporary civil servant in the Foreign Office, in the Department of Communications. And then she says, as a backroom boy, he was not allowed to enlist, though he served for a time in the Home Guard. At first, even his whereabouts were kept secret, but later it was divulged that he was working at Bletchley Park in Bletchley. No hint was ever given of the nature of his secret work, nor has it ever been revealed." Well, you all know that the codebreakers here were sworn to secrecy about their work, and you probably also know that the code of silence was broken in 1974 when Group Captain Winterbottom wrote his book called Top Secret Ultra. And then, of course, the floodgates were opened. Winterbottom's book doesn't actually mention Alan Turing, which you may also find quite interesting. But then, of course, what it did was it started this wave of interest in what had been going on at Bletchley, and the government caved into the pressure in 1975 and released quite a lot of information about the breaking of Enigma here, and then people started writing and making TV programmes about it and so forth. My grandmother died in 1976. She was about 93 at the time. And in the Alan Turing exhibition here at Bletchley, you can see a copy of a letter she received towards the end of her life, when the contribution that Alan had made to the war effort was just beginning to be understood. And I hope she was able to understand and appreciate that, but I think that even she would have been quite astonished about the depth and extent of interest that has been about her son since then and how much that has grown. Now, there's no denying that he was something of a strange character, and her book is absolutely full of anecdotes about Alan's eccentricities, and some of them date from his time at Bletchley, and I thought you might like to see what she said about some of those things. In the shelter during air raids, he knitted himself a pair of gloves, with no pattern to guide him, just out of his head. He was, however, defeated when it came to completion of the fingers. So he used to bicycle in from Shenley with little tails of wool dangling from his fingertips until one of the girls in his office took pity on him and closed up the ends. He found bicycling in the neighbourhood of Bletchley the worst possible thing for his acute hay fever, but he discovered that his gas mask gave him some protection from pollen and used this discovery without hesitation. As more than one friend has said, he was completely indifferent to the opinion of those who might deem his behaviour silly, judging as he did everything on its objective merits as he saw them. For him, the logical course was of more account than the conventional. And Professor Newman has already mentioned the Royal Society's biographical memoir, and there's a copy of that in the exhibition if you'd like to look at it. Professor Newman mentions the famous Bletchley bicycle with its insecure chain. Many colleagues have commented on his original method of dealing with this defect. He worked out that the chain came off after X revolutions of the pedals, and at first counted those revolutions so as to be ready to execute the necessary manoeuvre in order to keep the chain on. And this was tedious, so he fixed a little counter on the bicycle to warn him of the approaching trouble. When investigations were carried further, he discovered the mathematical relation between the number of pedal revolutions, the links in the chain, and the spokes in the wheel, and this showed that when the chain came off, when a slightly damaged link came into contact with a certain bent spoke, and the spoke was then straightened. This done, there was no more need to bring a bottle of turpentine and a piece of rag to the office to clean his hands after replacing the chain whenever it came off. A bicycle mechanic would have fixed it in 5 minutes. I expect you also know the story about the buried treasure. Anyway, but I thought you'd like to hear what my grandmother has to say about that. Early in the war, he realised that should Britain come under German occupation, bank accounts would be useless. He therefore bought 2 ingots of silver bullion, which he buried in 2 different spots, counting on recovery of the silver when the Germans should be driven out. He used to tell this story rather shamefacedly, though it was quite a sensible proceeding, had it been efficiently carried out. He conveyed the ingots in an ancient perambulator, and in lifting the heavy bars, slipped a disc. Though he retained a cryptic plan of the hiding places, he failed to discover the silver later when he used his homemade mine detector. Mr. Donald Mickey helped him, and in return for his assistance was offered a percentage of the value of the hidden treasure or his travelling and hotel expenses, plus £5 for each exhibition. He wisely chose the latter alternative. They set out armed with brown paper, spades and the perambulator to one side, but because the mine detector didn't prove strong enough and Alan was unsure of his landmarks, the ingot that was buried at that site was not found, nor anything further heard of that buried at the other spot. In my father's memoir, at the end of the new edition of the book, you can read his account of the ingots business. He is also quite careful to point out that the ingots were not buried here at Bletchley, and I thought I ought to point that out because we really don't want our visitors going around digging up the lawn later. One thing my grandmother found too painful to write about was Alan's prosecution for gross indecency and the treatment he was made to endure as a result of that and his death. And she, for one, never really accepted that suicide was the right explanation for what had happened. My father was quite closely involved in those events, and his perspective on it is rather different. I won't describe to you what he says, you can read it for yourselves, but I can tell you this, that from his perspective, it was dramatic as well as a very tragic tale. I think that the fact that the life and work of Alan Turing were cut short is something which many regard as a terrible tragedy. And one of the consequences of him not being very well known during his lifetime is there's very little remaining in the way of personal effects and property and things that people can remember him by apart from the mathematical papers. Now, we're very lucky here at Bletchley Park to have got a collection of his papers, but if, like me, the maths is a bit challenging for you, it's a bit daunting and it doesn't really give you a sense of the man behind the intellectual power. But what we have managed to do here at Bletchley is to draw together a small collection of some more personal artefacts, and they are in the Alan Turing exhibition. And I think together with the reissue of Sarah Turing's biography, you can now build up a little bit of a picture of the man and get some small window into what he was like. So for those of you who would like to, I understand that there is a possibility of a guided tour down to the Alan Turing exhibition. I'm getting enthusiastic nods from the back, so I'm right on that. And copies of the book are on sale here as well in the room just outside afterwards. But that's all I wanted to say, apart from thank you for coming to Bletchley today, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your visit.
Let me make a comment. Most of you will know Mavis Beatty.
And she told me that she had passed this into the Bletchley archives and so on at an earlier date.
She says the one thing that all Alan's biographers must get right is to show the inadequacy of the inquest with its verdict of suicide rather than accident. I was there when Keith Beatty, my husband, knew Alan and played chess with him, and told Jack Copeland that Alan's mother's account of the event was correct and why he knew this to be so. Keith was a good friend and close colleague of Professor James Lighthill when they worked together in the Royal Aircraft Establishment at Farnborough in the late 1950s. After James had retired from being Professor of Applied Mathematics at Manchester, where he had worked closely with Alan and was with him the night before he died. In fact, he said he'd never seemed more normal and had just bought two new pairs of socks, which is the last thing he would have done if he intended to commit suicide. He described the experiment he'd been doing with cyanide, just as Sarah Turing described it, which is quoted by Alan Hodges' biography. She warned him not to get cyanide on his hands when last she saw him. Wash your hands, Alan, keep your nails clean, and don't put your fingers in your mouth, she had said in vain. I can remember my mother nagging. Oh, well. Now that Sarah Turing's book has been republished, it's time to listen to his mother. Those who worked with Alan at Bletchley knew that cleanliness was not the top of his priorities. In any case, why should one go to the trouble of putting cyanide on an apple when it would have been so much easier just to drink it? Well, in fairness to Mavis, I wanted to add that, if you like, to Sarah's case. I don't myself really subscribe to it, but let us be quite clear. James Lighthill was a great man and would not have said that superficially. Could I just make another comment on Alan? I happened to meet Alan once and he lectured to me. I don't remember a word of the lecture. It was a group of us at TRE. But the comment I really wanted to make was it became fashionable, particularly about 10 years ago, to think of Alan as a huge eccentric who wasn't really fit to be let out alone. You have to remember that in January 1940, Alan was sent to France to negotiate with the Poles over the turnovers of the wheels.
He was sent there by himself. Now, is it really likely that an eccentric who couldn't control himself and so on would have been sent alone? And, of course, that got repeated when he went to Bell Labs for the development of the American bomb and the Bell Lab vocoder early in 1943.
Thank you.
I was wondering if you had any insight into why she left this family. Was it maternal love, or did she realise that there was some greatness there that needed to be recognised?
I think the answer to the question is probably a bit of both. It would be wrong to suggest that she was the first person whose son had become a Fellow of the Royal Society, but that was obviously a huge achievement of his that she was very proud of. She knew he'd been awarded an OBE for this secret stuff. I mean, OK, let's explode a small Bletchley myth. At least the Turing family knew what was going on here at Bletchley Park. They knew that Bletchley Park didn't have mathematicians here for random purposes because they were too eccentric and difficult to deal with. They had to be put away somewhere in some strange place near Bletchley to be kept out of the way so that people get on and run the war without interference. That wasn't what was going on. They were here for a reason. And people put two and two together and realised that the reason that you have mathematicians and linguists and people like that gathered together here is because we must be breaking the codes, or at least having a shot at it. People knew that. The detail of it absolutely was not to be revealed for decades. So I think she knew what he'd been doing, but she didn't know how he'd been doing it, whether it had been successful, what effect it had had on the war. That chapter was definitely closed. But there were chapters that were open. There was the work on the very challenging foundations of mathematics, the work that he'd been doing in the 1930s on the theoretical underpinning, if you like, the ground rules, the constitution of mathematics on the basis of which all mathematical problems and theorems are built. She knew that that had been very, very important. And the work that he'd done after the war, which I think captured the imagination of all school children at that stage. Put yourself back into Britain in the austerity years in the early 1950s. We are talking about atom bombs, we're talking about rockets that might go to the moon, and we're talking about this astonishing thing, which is an artificial brain. Alan was working on the British version of the artificial brain. He was speaking on the wireless about this. And those kinds of achievements were very well known. The work that he did on morphogenesis really, I don't think, came to be understood until much later. And it was really because he'd only begun to scratch the surface of it by the time that he died. So although she writes about that, I think whether it was an important contribution or not, probably wasn't able to be assessed at that stage. But I think from this you get the sense of somebody who recognises that she's got a very remarkable child. And because it's her child, then you put the two things together and that's why she wrote it. But I think it's since the Bletchley contribution became better understood that Alan's reputation has really taken off. I think it's really during the last 20 to 30 years that people have seen him as being somebody who is probably one of the great Britons. I'd let you make your own opinion on that one.
Obviously, your grandmother wrote very well. Had she written before?
Not that I'm aware of. Crikey, I'll try and do this, and excuse me if I get some of this wrong. The place where you can find the definitive answers to this is have a look at Andrew Hodges' masterly book about Alan Turing, and the family history is there in the early part. But roughly from what I can remember, Granny was born in the 1880s, Indian civil service type of background. We're talking about the days of empire here. Sent to school, Cheltenham Ladies' College, I think. Didn't fit in terribly well because she had an Irish accent. Sent out on the fishing fleet to find an eligible Indian civil service husband, so which is where she met my grandfather. Did the honourable thing, got married. Apparently they drank too much beer at Yellowstone National Park in the United States. So I think that's probably where the marriage and ultimately my father came from. So then she had the life of a memsahib in British Imperial India, you know, all through the period of the First World War, General Dyer at Amritsar, the attempt by the Indian nation to achieve independence from the Brits, difficult period. My grandfather retired from the Indian Civil Service in the mid-20s. He went to live in France to escape the ruinous British income tax rate. No, it wasn't 45p in the pound, it was 4 and sixpence, I think. But anyway, it was enough to want to be a tax exile. And then I think very soon after that, they moved back to the UK and to Guildford, and then my grandmother settled into the life of being a grandmother. And she was dearly, dearly loved by her grandchildren. I'm the fourth of her grandchildren, but the other three, who are all older than me, all remember her very, very fondly. And that sounds to me like a sort of a classic. It's an end of empire, but it's an end of empire, middle-class British life. And so where does the literary talent come from? I don't know. Well, if you believe in genetics, then she writes in the early part of her book about her own family and how there was a strong seam of obviously very bright but engineering sort of background ancestors of her own. So that doesn't give you literature, but it might give you some insight into where Alan's own genetic makeup was coming from. Before she got married, her surname was Stoney, which is an Irish name. But let me explain to those of you who aren't sort of students of Anglo-Irish history. There were the Anglo-Irish, who were the Protestants, who were this side of the Pale, and there were the Catholic Irish, who were beyond the Pale, and the Stonies were very much the Protestant, this side of the Pale, Anglo-Irish, like the Duke of Wellington. This can be a controversial area to get into, but the Irish accent will have come from that family background.
Firstly,
some of you may not have heard that. So Mr. Jarvis is asking me whether the silver ingots were made from melting down half crowns, which may have been something going on at the back of Hut 8, but I doubt it somehow. And do you need cyanide as part of the process for melting half crowns and turning them into silver ingots? I have to say I haven't heard that one before. I don't know. Is this a new one to you? Yes, my mother, who is here, is shaking her head, so I suspect that's a new one on us.
What is Codebreaker's Canard?
A Codebreaker's Canard, so there we are.
Yes, gentlemen, if you'd like to